Welcome to a very special podcast with Eliza Philby, who I met, as we were just saying, some time ago. And we've come across each other in academic circles and in contemporary politics and history, but most recently because of her dazzling work and influence around the future of family, the future of business, the future of education, around aging, family, generational shifts, bringing up young people. And the audience today is going to be very much parents with some students, no doubt, listening. And they'll be particularly interested in Eliza's most recent book, which was Inheritocracy. It's time to talk about the bank of mum and dad. But let's begin with your thinking. How did, Eliza, you get interested into all this work? And what was it about figures like Jeremy Corbyn and Theresa May that didn't captivate you and make you want to stay studying contemporary politics?
Indeed. Firstly, Anthony, thank you so much for inviting me on, and what a pleasure it is to have a chat. And as you referenced, our paths have crossed a number of times over the years, and most, I think, most obviously in that sort of contemporary British politics arena, and your brilliant work on the prime ministers, and my past work on Margaret Thatcher actually meant that we did collide in those academic circles. But really since around the sort of 2012, 2013, I decided that I wanted to shift away from talking about politics and analysing positions and people in power more to sort of societal trends. And particularly in that time, looking at the millennial generation, we were 4 years on from the financial crisis. I myself am a millennial working in academia, and I was someone who had, you know, studied, done well at school, consistently in exams, was the first person in my family to go to university, and had followed the educational route. And I was then an academic earning, frankly, a pretty poor wage, and realizing that the only way I was affording living in London at that time was very much through my sort of parents helping me. And around 2012 to 2013 was the time when the term bank of mum and dad really came into the public lexicon. And it became very obvious to me that the path that millennials were taking was in many instances similar, but in profound ways, very different to the ones to the past that their parents had taken. And I wanted to sort of explore that. I also was really hitting a sort of, I think, career crisis, where I was realizing that academia perhaps wasn't the path for me. I've always been a sort of entrepreneur, and indeed had started a business whilst doing my PhD, sort of very much thinking beyond just academia as my career path. And so I think I really wanted to sort of move out of academia and start speaking to the broader public, to business, and sort of to various different audiences that were essentially interested in this sort of the generational shifts that were happening in tech, in careers, in education, in family life, because yeah. I think that it really came to the fore post 2008, really.
So on that, as a teaser, just to get everyone really captivated, is it true, Eliza, that the children who are currently at school will be the first generation in 100 years not in aggregate to be enjoying a better standard of living than their parents? Or is that just an urban myth?
I'm going to be that annoying person that frames the question differently, because I think the real point here is that if they will do better than their parents, it's because of their parents and their parents' wealth. Because we are living in a society where your route to opportunity is increasingly less to do with how educated you are or how well you do in education, less to do with actually what job you go into, your profession, your wage, and ever more to do with whether you have access or not to the bank of mum and dad. And that's what I call, the inheritocracy, destroying the meritocracy that characterized the late 20th century sort of time frame, really. And that is a genuine shift. And you know, the millennials on average will inherit their parents' money around the age of 65, which means most of it will probably go to their kids, if not grandkids. And so that perpetuating of family wealth will define the next 40 to 50 years.
So are we going to come into all of that? Let's just pick up on this term familiar to some, many perhaps, but not all, millennials. When did the coining of this phrase for these different bands of young people originate, and how descriptively valuable are they? Can you just run over them?
I think it's a brilliant question, actually, because I frame analysis through that sort of those brackets of generations, and let's just go through them. So the baby boomers, that generation that came of age and came into being immediately after the Second World War, but actually encompass a 20-year time frame from 1944 to 1964. Now there were peaks and troughs in that population boom, but the baby boomers are a considerable cohort and have yielded considerable wealth, economic power, political power ever since, because there are so many of them. And that's that generation that also really entered a world from cradle to grave care, a period of rising social mobility and increasing returns on a professional career and a tertiary education. So that there really are an exceptional generation. There will never be a generation like the baby boomers in the West ever again, which is why we should see them as the exception, not the norm. The next generation is Gen X, those born from 1965 to 1980. And before they were known as Gen X, which, by the way, for those that don't know, was a book written in the 1990s by American author Douglas Copeland, trying to establish that generation after the boomers. This is the generation that came into being, obviously, in the 1990s, came into sort of their early youth in the 1990s. They were sort of, I think there's three things that really characterize them. That's the generation that don't have as much wealth as the boomers, that are were known as the baby bust before they were known as Gen X. They're the generation where women started to outnumber men at university, and thus has been the story ever since. So you've got that mass entry of women into the professionalized workplace in the 1990s, the kind of Bridget Jones generation, the Sex and the City generation, greater female financial empowerment. They are also the generation that are the first tech generation and the sort of birth of individualism, I think, with the sort of the Sony Walkman, very different from the jukebox. That was a collective experience. The Sony Walkman was the first piece of private technology. And then you saw the emergence of private technology in the workplace with the BlackBerry. And that begins to kind of create the idea of the individualized worker. But also critically, sorry, go on.
Well, I'm going to ask. I mean, I have to ask about the Filofax, and also where are the Filofax written, Eliza? And why was it Gen X? Why did he name it Gen X?
The Gen X was the sort of, well, I mean, there's lots of sort of precursors to Douglas Copeland's book, but this idea of the sort of seemingly a sort of marking point of a turning point in history. And that before they were then known as the MTV generation, it's quite interesting how, for baby boomers, there's an obvious demographic link to their name. Every generation after that, it's sort of, very tenuous as to what the names are. But the really important thing about Gen X right now is that the squeeze generation, squeeze between looking after their kids. Now, looking after your kids now in the 21st century has become a 30-year financial commitment. The average parent in the UK believes they will be funding their kid up until the age of 29. Gen X is frightening, right? But that's considering
most of the people listening will be, Eliza, Gen X parents.
Exactly. This is why I'm zooming in on this generation, because they're very sort of ignored and forgotten, but actually they're pivotal right now, squeezed between looking after their kids and many looking after elderly parents. And maybe elderly parents go through the social care system, maybe elderly parents, in other countries, that challenge that we all now have in an aging society with aging demographics of elder care being as much of a responsibility as childcare. So they're sort of sort of pioneers in so many ways, Gen X. Then you have the millennials. Now, millennials, of course, were before they were known as millennials, were known as Gen Y, because after X comes Y. But they assumed the title of millennials because obviously they turned into adults, the eldest of them, at the millennium. And that's those born from 1981 to 1997. And what's interesting about millennials, of course, is I call them the in-betweeners, because they're the generation that sort of were told very much kind of, you know, pursue that late 20th century dream, which is get to university, get on the housing ladder, you know, get on the professional path. That is the pathway to professional, stable, financial stability, et cetera, et cetera. And it didn't really work out like that. It didn't really work out like that because, frankly, wages have stalled since the 2008 financial crisis. And they entered an economy where certain things became cheap. You know, technology, of course, the smartphone is synonymous with the smartphone. Travel, you know, they're synonymous with travel as a status symbol. They're synonymous with, food becoming a lot cheaper, as it did, which is why, you know, coffees and avocado on toast became synonymous with that generation. But they also hit an economy where certain things became expensive. And this is the critical thing: housing, education, healthcare, depending on where you are in the world, childcare. And as they entered adulthood, those wages bought them less. And they entered a workplace where increasingly, to buy the big ticket in items in life, you had to rely, if you had access to this, the bank of mum and dad. And so the divide within that generation is between those that have the bank of mum and dad and those that don't. And then the next generation, Gen Z. Go back.
There's so much I want to ask about. But why do we know why housing became relatively so much more expensive?
Oh, loads of reasons. I mean, gosh, I mean, it's
where do you begin?
Question of our time. And it's not a UK-centric problem. It's problematic across certainly the big cities across the Western world, but also actually now increasingly the smaller cities. And, you know, we're not building enough. There is a sluggish home property market. You know, 50% of baby boomers live in houses with two spare bedrooms. Not that we should compulsory purchase those properties, but it is indicative of a amount of wealth in the baby boomer generation. You know, about approximately £5 trillion of property wealth in the baby boomer generation. One in five baby boomers is a millionaire, and that's largely through property wealth. But that hasn't trickled down. And you know, essentially what's also happened critically is that wages have not kept a pace with house prices. It's not just that house prices have become really expensive. It's that wages haven't increased with them. And it's only people that work in private equity or corporate law where wages have kept a pace with house prices.
Really?
So
just?
Yes. Yeah.
Just those two?
Yeah. So what's interesting, it's slightly different story in the US, it's slightly different story in the EU, but not massively. And so what we have in that generation is the promise, the broken promise. And this is where, you know, one's sort of frustration or it has a lot in politics or in life is largely rooted in your expectations. And millennials had great expectations. And I think one of the reasons why they're so frustrated is because those expectations have not been met by the education system, by the work environment, and certainly by the political class.
Just about half the parents listening to this will be Gen X and the other half will be millennials. And there'll be a few just on either the groups on either end of those. Did Gen X, did the millennials have as good a time? Is there any way of measuring that as Gen X?
You can see this in culture. I think, you know, if you think about, crudely, if you think about sort of the lionizing and the romanticization of the professional career in the 1990s. You know, you had Ally McBeal, the sort of first female sort of lawyers. You had, Friends, the sitcom. You know, everyone, they're all sort of sitting around in Central Perk Coffee House. You know, life is very relaxed. You can sort of slum it as an artist. And, you know, that sort of idea of sort of an aspirational youth becomes very sobering for millennials who hit the workplace at the time of the financial crisis. And, you know, it's not all kind of Sex and the City. It's much more serious, and it's much more infantilized. And what's a great indicative of a kind of indicator of this is the emergence of what I call kidulthood. So if you look at how adulthood has evolved in the last 25 years of this century, millennials and now Gen Z are doing things later than their parents. They are finishing their education later. They are getting married, if at all, late. They are becoming financially independent of their parents much later than their parents did of their parents. They're having babies much later than their parents did. And what that is a consequence of is not just financial constraints. It's harder to do the adulting stuff. It's also, you know, and I think that sort of protracted adulthood, particularly one that's frankly funded by your parents, is something that's become quite a societal norm. You know, back in 2010, it used to be sort of a term of ridicule to be a boomerang kid, you know, who's moved back in with their parent after university. Now, the hotel of mum and dad is like basically a norm. And particularly in a tightening labour market, you know, parents now just expect their kids to come back home after university and try and sort of, you know, gradually get a job and make it in the professional workspace. For many, you know, and actually it's not just that, though, you know, middle class kids we're talking about here, working class kids increasingly too. Parents, you know, multi-generational households have risen largely because of younger adults living with their parents longer.
So do Gen X and millennials, do they parent differently because of these changed circumstances? Is there a more typical behaviour of a millennial parent to a Gen X parent? And do they make friends with each other, or do they tend to, are their friendship groups tend to be with those?
So, I mean, there's lots that, I mean, one of the things that you can definitely say about families today, as opposed to families 40 years ago, is number one, there's less hierarchy, more democracy. So, you know, crudely speaking, baby boomers grew up in households where children should be seen and not heard. And there was a level of deference to one's parents. Now, you know, this is cultural as well as generational, of course, and every family is different. But you could say that what has happened in smaller families with both parents working and slightly less time on people's hands, it used to be that children were scared of their parents, and now parents are scared of their kids. And there is a level of deference to the child. You know, just think, for example, I was in the car with my kids this weekend, and they were saying, "Can we put on more our music, please?" What? And I was like, "Our music? Can we listen to our music in the car?" And I was like, we do often, we did a road trip last year to France, and we often listen to their music in the car. Now, that wouldn't have happened 30 years ago. It would have been the parents' music that was listened to in the car. And it's just a very small indication of how in households in the 21st century, the children have a voice. You know, what do you want for dinner? What do you want for Christmas? Where should we go on holiday? The deference to the child as opposed to the deference to the parent has definitely become, it's not isolated to one generation of parents, and it's not all parents, of course. But you combine that with a sort of tech culture where everyone has a voice through a phone. You know, it's not a smartphone, it's a megaphone, amplifying your needs, your wants, your desires, your actions. What are you wearing today? Where are you going on holiday? It's constantly feeding this expectation that your voice is important. And then you have an education system which is highly standardized. Of course it is, it has to be, but it's also highly individualized. And so this idea of the individual, which as we know in a hyper-focused algorithmic tech culture has turned us all into quite atomized individuals who believe in our own self-importance and story, is actually there is a decline of the collectives, the rise of the individual, and it's most pronounced around the dinner table and in the car.
Tell us more about the car, the music and the dinner table, and you're going to have to mention the Filofax there. The file a legacy issue on the file of
backs. I think the file of backs is just a precursor to the iCal tyranny that we all live under now, where most adults' timetables now look like they're school kids. And, you know, it's boom, 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 meeting, 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 meeting. And I think, you know, it's just the regulation of time that, you know, hypercapitalism has done to us all. And the file of facts was the sort of precursor, more innocent, heavier version of what we've all got now, which is our timetables are constantly, you know, telling us what to do.
And yes, I do know there'll be some listeners who won't even know what a file of facts is. Okay. So this sense of increased autonomy and how you deal with that, and I think many parents, or maybe I'm wrong here, Eliza, will feel threatened by their more assertive children, because they'll remember their own. They remember in their parents' cars, you know, it was parents' music who were choosing. It wasn't just the parents' music was then better music, but that they were choosing.
You sat there in silence, you know?
And round the table, yeah. So now,
and also, this is all... hold that thought, because I think it's all indicative of actually a much nicer, more important story here, is that actually the rebellion, the teenage rebellion that is synonymous with the kind of baby boomer generation, actually even the generation before that in the 50s, of rebelling against their elders. It was the, you know, the whole point of being young was to mock, was to rebel, was to be deviant against, you know, authority and your elders. And what's interesting is in the 21st century, the opposite has happened. You know, the biggest rise in sexually transmitted diseases, by the way, is in the baby boomer generation. It's not in young people. We've seen an absolutely, you know, decline of people having sex or claiming to have sex. You know, those figures are always, those data points are always sort of should be taken with a pinch of salt. But the point is that people are getting along with their parents and even their grandparents now much more than previous generations. They're living together. They're going on holiday together. You know, one in three Gen Zers has gone clubbing with their mother. They're, you know, they're on sharing social media, you know, swapping social media content together. The closeness of the family is as much to do with, you know, economics, but also cultural values, you know, and that's partly, you know, a shift in acceptance of, you know, sex before marriage, the decline of religion, greater acceptance around, you know, homosexuality. You know, there is actually a greater sense of cultural alignment between the generations now than there was 40 years ago. And that's actually something that's not talked about enough. And that's partly to do with just cultural shifting, cultural norms. But there is actually a really important economic reliance that young people now have on their parents that they did not have in the 50s and 60s and 70s. Quite often the money was going the other way. When my mum still lived at home, you know, when she was 16, she had to pay her mum keep. She was paying, you know, and contributing to the household budget, as children were expected to do. You know, for a long time, really throughout history, children were a net gain to the household. Now they are definitely a net drain. And that's partly as well combined with this idea and fear, particularly prevalent amongst middle class households, of course, is my kids won't do as well as I did. So I have to invest in my children. And look at the way we use the language of finance in the realm of parenting. You know, we parent, it is a verb now, and we invest in our children in the hopes that it, you know, it compounds and they are successful. And one of the things that's really defined early childhood, young childhood, and early adulthood in the 21st century is this overwhelming pressure that is now put on young people, their inability to fail, their absolute need to pass exams, this sort of idea that youth is not, you know, you can't make any mistakes, is, I think, one of the really fundamental reasons why young people are suffering from high levels of anxiety. This idea that they cannot fail, I think, is one of the biggest sort of negative sort of innovations of the last 20 years.
Undoubtedly. And so let's take, let's go on and move beyond millennials. Let's just cover the latter, most recent cohorts.
Yes. So we have Gen Z, that's those born from 1997 to 2010. And that's those who cannot remember the 20th century, potentially some of your people that sort of, you know, they're over the age of 14 now. They are the ones who are, you know, most exposed to the AI revolution in the workplace at the moment and the impact that it's having on labour market. Most, obviously, most exposed to the increasing cost of particularly tertiary education, with the average Gen Zer now graduating with around, you know, around 50k debt. A generation that is, you know, has not just grown up with a smartphone in their pocket since the age of 13 on average, but has obviously been exposed to social media before we really understood what that meant and its impact on people's lives. That means that comparison culture, of course, which can be as aspirational, damaging as it can be aspirational. They've also had access to the world's information in their pocket, which I think is one of the reasons why there's been that decline of deference, that decline of wonder, that rise of cynicism. And I think really critically, though, they've had access to the world's marketplace in their pocket. And they're looking at millennials going, you've done the professional track, you've had stagnant wages, you cannot afford a home without your parents. I'm not necessarily buying into that narrative. And one of the really fascinating data sets that we've been looking at with Gen Z is the massive rise of Gen Zers investing in the stock market and thinking about life beyond a wage. And listeners at home might know, you know, young people sort of financially educating themselves on TikTok or YouTube and investing, micro investing, all of that. It swelled during the pandemic when people had a lot of time in their hands, but it's been a consistent theme since around 2019 of young people investing their money. And I think that's symptomatic of a generation who do not believe in one salary alone.
Should they be going to university?
Now, this is an interesting one because I think, yes, overall, there is obviously been a decline in the graduate premium, actually a rise in wages for non-graduates. But ultimately, it is still of most benefit to you for your long-term career prospects to go to university. Now, whether that's the same in 10 years' time, and I don't know. I'm not 100% convinced on that. But I do think it's not whether you should go to university. I think what we need to realize what's happening here is it worth the price? What am I getting from that? And we've seen, you know, I worked in higher education for 10 years. One of the things that I saw as students became customers was them deeper sort of questioning of, am I going to get a job at the end of this, and what am I getting while I'm here? And what that means is, of course, yes, you've created customers rather than just learners, which actually a lot of academics found very difficult to stomach. But the reality was that they weren't just thinking knowledge for knowledge's sake, let me luxuriate in this, you know, seminar dynamic, thank you very much. They were thinking, okay, but, you know, are you going to help me get that internship? Are you going to help me, like, actually hone my skills for the workplace? Are you going to actually, you know, not just do the online Zoom lecture? Are you actually going to put the notes online? And if I knock on your door, are you going to know my name? And that's where I think the tension is. It's not so much is university still worth it, is what am I getting for the money? Because, and this is, I've just done a big piece on this for my Substack, is the graduate debt is a particular debt for women than men, because if you have children, it is a debt that is a lifetime tax on your income. Men tend to pay it off and particularly the high earners tend to pay it off. But if it's going to be a long time tax, what am I getting for that? And that's where the real question is.
And Gen Z's relations with parents, with mothers and fathers, how's that changed going all the way back to boomers and Gen X? Do they see their parents in different ways? They see them more as friends, daughters even unheard of, wanting to wear the same clothes as their mothers. What's happening there, mothers and dads?
Yeah, so what's really... The big shift is that... Two big shifts, really, is that now, on average, most late Gen X's millennial parents are in dual-income households. So it's no longer the sort of traditional male breadwinner household. And that means two things. Number one, both parents working, both parents potentially quite stressed, both parents time short, but fewer children and an investment in those children. So now, today, working mothers spend more time directly with their kids than non-working mothers did in the 1970s. So that idea of like parent and child time becomes like really focused in an environment where both parents are working and time is short.
Yeah.
The second thing, and that, by the way, that can be quite pressured. That doesn't necessarily mean that you're all having a great time. It means actually it's like you feel the pressure to have a good time. And I've done a lot of work doing focus groups with Gen Zers, particularly girls with professional mothers. And I remember one of them saying to me, you know, mum was always either stressed getting ready for holiday or stressed on holiday because she wasn't working. And actually, I don't want to work as hard as my mother. And you know, when you speak to Gen X women with daughters, they very much see themselves as being, you know, smashing that glass ceiling so their girls don't have to suffer from any of those constraints. But actually, a lot of their daughters are saying, well, actually, I saw you really stressed under an increasingly digitalized workplace in which you weren't able to switch off.
And
you know, so that's kind of stressful parenting of life admin, dual income households, digitalized workplace. Climax during the pandemic, of course. So that's the first thing. The second thing is rising sort of greater sort of presence of fathers. And I think this is, you know, net overall positive, but let's look at the story here. So millennial dads push more pushchairs, you know, change more nappies, do more when it comes to every stage of childhood than any other dads before them. Right. And it's not because they love their kids more. It's not because they love their kids more. The barefaced fact is that fathers have had to step up, you know, on the domestic front because, you know, women have stepped up on the economic front. And so in order for modern marriages to work in a time when it is more and more expensive to hire help, and it's more and more difficult to live near families and lean on that village, fathers have had to step up on the domestic front. And they have, although I would say that's a half-finished revolution and workplaces and school places, schools still don't get it and they still send all of the admin to the mother. But I do think that the fundamental structuring of care is changing. And I've just written a big piece for City AM about my own mistakes of being a female breadwinner. My husband lost his job and he stepped up into the caring role predominantly and I stepped into the breadwinner role. And actually, I wasn't very nice to him in the process, but it was actually really difficult for me to do that. I found it emotionally very difficult to relinquish control on that front and to be the hard earner, traveling quite a lot, actually, which was very lonely and not fun. And I think modern marriages are not built for breadwinners and modern families, frankly, are not built on breadwinners anymore. They are in boardrooms and you know, isolated high net worth families and certain salary brackets. But by and large, most middle class families now, like working class families, have to be dual income households. And that's a real shift.
And should we be doing more at school, Eliza, to teach people about being parents and thinking about being parents and or not? Or is it, can you not teach it? I mean, what is a good parent and has it changed? And there's so many things I want to ask, and I've got less than 10 minutes.
I think there's one thing that does need to be discussed, and it's a really, really controversial issue, is that when you have a kid, you basically, as a mother, right? This is a mother, but also the same principle. You start inside you, and literally it's a parasite inside you, stealing all your food, you know, destroying your body, and, you know, it's ripped out of you during birth. And for me, it was very much ripped out of me. And then, you know, gradually you sow the seed of independence, and whether that's them learning to walk, obviously talk, going to school, going to secondary school, relying on their peers more than you, going to university, leaving home, and gradually you are creating, and this is how we should think about it, is you are raising an adult, not a child. And, you know, that is what, you know, it happens in biology. You know, you are putting the child out of the pride. And I think one of the things that we're not doing in modern culture is really creating independent individuals. And frankly, that is the basis of resilience, it seems to me. One of the, you know, the dependency culture, you know, people talk about dependency on the state. Actually, frankly, dependency on the parents is much worse. So now one in four Gen Zers in America take their parents to a work interview. You've got an overwhelming involvement of parents at university level. You know, when I was a university lecturer, I remember the master department saying to me on one of the open days, can you do that lecture on Margaret Thatcher for, you know, for them all? And I was like, why? Like, literally, the kids would have, you know, not been born though she was, you know, when she was around. He said, no, not for the kids, but for the parents. They're the customers. Now, firstly, I would argue the parents even be at the open day. You know, my parents never came to my open day. You know, we've also seen, you know, decline of kids learning to drive because the parents are the chauffeurs. Also declining kids working because parents are saying, do your homework. You know, this massive decline in independence and friction, allowing your kids to fail, allowing your kids to fuck up, allowing your kids to do things wrong, allowing your kids to learn from those mistakes. I don't think we do that enough. And I'm, as a parent who grew up with, you know, stranger danger warnings, PISA educational league tables, all of that sort of pressure around, you know, pushing your child to achieve. I think we need to take a step back and realize what are the skills and the qualities that are going to really enable them to be agile beings and, frankly, mature adults. And agility in the age of AI is the thing they need. It's not
agility in the age of AI.
Exactly. Right.
Absolutely.
That is the thing they need.
Eliza.
High agency people is what we need to be creating.
That's exactly what's going on with the education system. It's exactly what we're trying to get right, working with Changing PISA, which is the international tables where you measure schools that have done so much damage by narrowing kids down, and creativity and individuality and autonomy down. And let's just finish off rapidly on just a quick word about the final generation after Gen Z.
Gen Alpha. Gen Alpha are the generation that's grown up with on-demand TV and shouting at Alexas. So they're going to be, you know, even more and now sort of bespoke AI sort of algorithms just telling them sort of what their needs, wants are, and desires are.
But these are 2010 to where?
Yeah, 2010 to actually now there's a next generation after them, Generation Beta, that are born after 2025. But I think the most important thing here is that it's not about generational brackets. That's a convenient sort of way of just analysing what we're talking about here, which is societal change. And fundamentally, you know, I spend a lot of my time thinking about Gen Alpha, and we're just about to do a big series on my Substack on them. You know, I think there's some, you know, worrying trends. The big surge in use of glasses, for example, amongst Gen Alpha is because they've grown up on screens. The big surge in childhood obesity, you know, one in four children of Generation Alpha are leaving primary school obese. A big rise in, anxiety amongst Gen Alpha. They're the generation that were at primary school during the COVID and potentially, you know, possibly, we don't know yet, but suffered the greatest under that whole.
And there'll be a lot of parents listening with Gen Alpha kids. Best advice, single piece of advice I'm going to give you in the time left. Best advice to them.
I think the most important thing is teach them how to be human. And that's collaboration with others, soft skills, being able to have emotional literacy, understand You know, body language, you know, keep them in their bodies, keep them, you know, independent of mind, critical evaluation skills. And I work with businesses all the time. What they're looking for is no longer exam results. They are looking for high agency individuals who can solve problems, who can manage others, and who can work alongside others and be the most human you can possibly be at a time when AI increasingly does the mundane.
And last question, Eliza, optimistic about the future or not?
Yes, it's never been better time to start a business, build a career, you know, live a great life, be a woman, be different, be neurodiverse, be, you know, gay. It genuinely, we are living in a time when freedom is more nuanced than ever before. However, we also are living in a time when we need to be super alert to how change is happening and not be swallowed up in hysterics or trends or, you know, looking at the bigger picture. And I think as parents, the best way we can do that is just, you know, protect our children to a certain degree, but also expose them to things that are really, really important, as I said, and that's the friction of modern life and exposing them to an, you know, a world beyond the, you know, cloisters and a sort of really getting them to think entrepreneurially, getting them to think about, you know, not just themselves, getting them to think how they can connect and build trust with others, how they can teach others, but also be great educators, how they can speak, but also listen, how they can care as for others as well as themselves. Because a generation that's grown up on self-care isn't that great when it comes to caring for others. We need to be thinking much more in terms of collaboration and education, because fundamentally, that is what's going to help us sort of mitigate the challenges of the 21st century.
Inadvertently, Eliza, you have been talking, particularly in the last 10, 15 minutes, about the very thing that Wellington is leading the country on, which is embedding the human in education and reminding people what it means, the supreme importance of what it means to be a human being rather than just to be smart at passing exams. Now, that was Eliza Philby, a very, very brilliant thinker and practitioner, as you know, referring there to generation shift, how generation evolution is changing the way we think, work and live in 2023, and then inheritocracy. It's time to talk about the Bank of Mum and Dad. That was 2024. You can read her regularly and listen to her across the media and YouTube series It's All Relative and the weekly newsletter hashtag MajorRelate. So, Eliza, thank you from all of us. That was wonderful.
Thank you.